From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We are so proud of you and so thankful for you and for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, March 27th is the Christian celebration of Easter Sunday, the Feast of the Resurrection of Christ. Monday is the Zoroastrian observance of Kardad Sal, and Wednesday is the Jain Feast of Mahavir Jayanti. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, the horrific terror attacks on Brussels this week claimed numerous innocent lives and provided for a new round of ill-informed rhetoric brimming with ignorance, fear, and hate. Sadly, even if predictably, among the worst were several presidential candidates. Ted Cruz suggested police should patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods before they become radicalized as a solution. Donald Trump doubled down on his favorite themes, closing borders, banning Muslims, and waterboarding. Politics, as usual, despite us living in very unusual times indeed. Trump's address to the influential American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's conference this week had an unprecedented follow-up. Organizers publicly apologized for the political and divisive nature of his speech and for the cheers it received from some in attendance. In a hastily called session, the North Carolina State Legislature rushed through a mean-spirited anti-transgender bill. This and similar initiatives are getting support from something called the American College of Pediatricians, an anti-gay front group that the Southern Poverty Law Center has branded a hate group. Five-hour lines at primary polling stations in Arizona and elsewhere underscore just how misguided the Supreme Court's gutting of the Voting Rights Act really was. Drastic reductions in voter access are going to lead only to greater problems come the general election in November. And an 8-member Supreme Court heard arguments in the latest religiously couched challenge to the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act, Little Sisters of the Poor versus Burwell. There's a very real chance the ruling could be a 4-4 tie. Now, ordinarily, we would be taking this weekend off, like most other programs. But the truth is, there's just too much to talk about, and it's all important, and so we've got a fresh edition of State of Belief for your Easter weekend. With President Obama having concluded his historic visit to Cuba, a lot of ink has been spilled about his efforts to end the longstanding estrangement between the two nations, with a lot of assumptions and misunderstandings of Cuba thrown into the commentary. Because I happen to have spent time in that country myself, and I have treasured relationships with friends and faith leaders there, I thought this was an important opportunity to explore some of the poorly understood aspects of life, religious and otherwise, in this nearby neighbor. And so, on this program, you'll hear from Pastor Eduardo Gonzalez about his Christian ministry in this communist nation. You'll meet a Louisiana lawyer who's played an important role in a decades-long partnership between Eduardo's church and the one that I serve as pastor. And I'll also speak to the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, former head of the U.S. Office of the World Council of Churches and deeply involved with working in Cuba. So, here we go. To a great many Americans, Cuba is an alien island nation known for cigars, rum, and antique cars. Cut off from the neighboring United States economically, culturally, and politically. It's a dictatorship. It's poor. It's communist, people will say. No American could go there for decades, they believe. Oddly, it's the fatherland of one current and one former 2016 presidential candidates, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. But it's also home to a vibrant culture, including diverse communities of faith, and it's that story that I want to share with you today. We'll begin with my dear friend, the Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell. And Joan, it's great to welcome you back to State of Belief.
Thank you. I feel like I'm home now.
Joan, you have been in and out of Cuba numerous times across the years. In fact, when this interview airs, you will be in Cuba again. Indeed, we both share a love for the Cuban people. And I want to begin by asking you to tell our listeners something about Cuba that they likely don't know and will be surprised to learn.
My granddaughter, who is 24 years old, is now the first American to be studying for the ministry in Cuba.
My goodness.
And I think it will surprise people that they have a strong Protestant seminary in Cuba, in Matanzas. Welton, you and I have both been to Matanzas. Mm-hmm. The seminary there is over 70 years old. It's not new to Cuba. And my earliest relationships to Cuba were through that seminary. And so you can imagine what it means to a grandmother to know that her granddaughter is studying in Spanish in Cuba to be a minister here in these United States. So Cuba has come home, and I'm happy to have a granddaughter that speaks fluent Spanish. It makes a big difference.
What else do you think of about Cuba that probably most people in the United States don't understand?
I think a lot of people do not understand the Cuban people themselves. We worry about their poverty and so forth. But by and large, of course, not everybody, but Cuban people tend to be happy people. And we always in our own country seem to think we're going to go down there and we're going to find people in utter despair. The fact of the matter is, it's quite the opposite. Some of the great accomplishments of Cuba are in both education and in medicine. And 99% of Cuban children are good readers. They have been through the basics of school, and those who show their capacity intellectually go on without added expense to college. And I think their commitment to education and to health are two of the great gifts of Cuba. The Cuban doctors go around the world and often appear in places where terrible diseases have taken over, and it's the Cuban doctors that brave the area they're going into in order to give help.
John, you've had a long-time relationship with Fidel Castro. Usually, when you're in Cuba, the two of you get together. How do you think Fidel is reacting to the transformation that is occurring between the United States and Cuba?
You know, I have two feelings about it. One, I spent some time with Castro within this last year, and my granddaughter that I talked about, he let her be the interpreter for our conversation, which was quite a remarkable thing. And I met with him in his house. He lives in a very modest home. I had not ever met his wife before, his wife of many years. He's 90 years old, and she's probably maybe in her early 80s. They have a long-time relationship. And so I think that we don't really know Castro very well. It must be difficult for him. I know that with the United States president being there, he was politely told that this would be in the hands of his brother, who now serves as the head of the Cuban government. And I can't imagine how tough it must be for Fidel to sit in his home and listen to the television like the rest of us are doing. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he knows a few more things than we do. But I also do believe that whatever disagreements we may have with Fidel, and there are some to have, he cares deeply about the Cuban people, and I think he believes that the relationship to the United States has a better chance right now than it's had in a very long time.
Joan, how do you characterize him, not when talking about politics or controversial things, but just what kind of man does he strike you as being?
When Pope John Paul came, I said to Fidel Castro, I said, "And how did you feel about your meeting with the Pope?" And he said, "Well, I think he liked me." And that was a deeply surprising answer to me. And I said, "Do you care whether he likes you?" And he looked at me very seriously, and he said, "Of course I care. My mother's a Catholic." And I think that in him is this Catholic heritage, and he was educated by the best of the Catholics. And he also has things to say about the church that are terribly critical, about how he felt they didn't enter in when gamblers were taking over the country. So I think he's not praising all the way, but deep in him is his own heritage. And I think that, unfortunately, because our two countries have not spoken to one another in open and friendly ways, perhaps not for years, and for those few of us who have come to know the Cuban officials, it's not that they're perfect any more than, you know, nobody gets more criticism than the President of the United States. And the same is true in Cuba. People have issues with Fidel. People who come to visit have issues with him. But by and large, he has taken the Cuban people out of a terrible time in history, which for those of us like me who are in their 80s, we remember that time in history when it was controlled by somebody who was very, very much into gambling and illegality and prostitution. And we watched Castro bring Cuba out of that to a time when 99% of their people are literate. It doesn't make him perfect. It doesn't make Cuba perfect. And when I watched our president this morning, I thought he did a good job of praising Cuba for what they deserve praise for and calling to their attendance the issues that are before Cuba. I remember one of my most important Cuban men that I knew, a wonderful man by the name of Alarcón. He said once, "It's never the right time for Cuba when it comes to the United States." So my prayer, Welton, is that this is the right time, and that perhaps the words of our president this morning will take root, and there will be change, and that we will embrace it here as well as there.
Joan, what are your own personal hopes for a Cuban government that is more sensitive to human rights? Can this come under a member of the Castro family, or will more radical changes in leadership on the island have to take place?
I think the young woman who is their Secretary of State, or equivalent to our Secretary of State, is one who holds out some hope for us of another generation. Both Castros now. Castro's brother is in his mid-80s. Castro himself is 90. And both of them, if you speak to them, they will say their time, which was to bring the revolution into being, is to be passed on. I suppose they know, they haven't told me by and large, who the next person will be, but they do hint at the fact that within 2 years there will be a new person governing Cuba. You know, the truth of the matter is, Welton, we don't honestly know what is happening in Cuba in relation to human rights. We have a terrific bias about it here in this country, and there is some quiet about it in Cuba. It's very tough to find out the reality. I'm sure it is not as bad as some people would frame it in this country, but perhaps neither is it as good as it might be said by the government. Governments do have a way of making what they've done look good, and we're as guilty of that as they are.
Yeah. Joan, I remember well the period of time when you were working with the Gonzalez family to get that young man back to Cuba, and that you were doing it despite pressure from high places, including the White House, trying to persuade you to halt your efforts. For you, what was that all about? Why was that so important to you?
It wouldn't matter what country we were in or what. When you know a family, I knew the grandmother, I knew the father, I knew a lot of the family members. And it would be very interesting to people to know that I was not privileged to help get Elian home until I had met with his family. And what that meant was that I went to Cuba and I was interviewed in deep ways by the family, which amounted to about 40 people, all gathered in a small house to say, what do I want to do? What do I think I could do? And yes, they wanted Elian to be home, but they wanted to be sure that he was also going to be safe. And so it became for me something very, very special.
Not everybody's going to remember. I didn't say just a word or two about Elian and what the situation was.
Well, Elian's mother fell in love with a young man. Nothing so surprising in that, but left her husband. And it just happened that this man was a man who had been a trafficker in taking people back and forth between Cuba and the United States, both of which was illegal. And his favorite activity was getting a small boat, charging people a fairly good sum of money, and then taking them out of Cuba if they wanted to come to the United States. Elian's was at that point a little boy, 5 years old, and his mother, who had fallen in love with the man who was running this boat back and forth and had, in fact, been in prison, both in Cuba and in the United States, she was going to go on the boat with him. And when the time came, he wouldn't take her unless she brought Elian with her. She did not want to take Elian, but he was 5 years old. She did take him with her. The boat drowned, as many of those boats did, because they were small, they were not good enough for the waters between Cuba and the United States. And obviously, she had wrapped this little boy up in everything that she had and put him on the only raft, and it was a little rubber raft. And he was found in the ocean. 3 days, he must have been, they figure, might have been 3 days on the ocean. His mother was dead. The Coast Guard found him, brought him in, put him in the hospital. And when he woke up in the hospital, he said, "Where's my daddy?" And, of course, his father was in Cuba, and here he was in the United States. And he was then picked up in the hospital by the brother of his grandfather. Nobody would have guessed at that point that that man was very much in touch with the Cuban mafia in Miami. And they saw that keeping this little boy in the United States would make a great story and hopeful to bring Castro down. As it turned out, the American people found out that this young boy had a beautiful family, a father, two grandmothers, a great-grandmother, all looking for him back in Cuba, and Cuba was home for him. And it took almost a year to get him returned home. But by that time, it is now estimated that over 80% of the American people, they had met the father on television, they had heard the story about the mother, and I think the American people began to say, this little boy deserves to be home with his parents. He has a strong family.
I know that you're still in touch with Elian. Tell us about how he's doing.
Well, he's 24 years old, maybe 25 by now. He has graduated now from college. All Cubans have to be in the Army for 2 years, and he's now serving his time in the Army. He is now promised to a lovely young woman, which he has a promise ring. He has really grown up. He's grown up with his father. His father remarried. They have two children, and those are Elian's brothers. He lives with them as brothers. The grandmother is still alive, and I see her every time I go to Cuba. The great-grandmother has died, and he has lived happy life.
Right.
And a very secure life there. The Cuban government made a promise, which I thought was quite remarkable, that they would not make an issue of him and that they would not expose him to the press. They would protect him so that, in fact, he would be able to get his education as an average child and to the degree possible. Every now and then they've had to protect him, mostly from American people who want to take pictures, and what they don't want is to have his story continue.
Sure.
They want him to lead a normal and ordinary life. And by and large, he has pretty much been able to do that. And to the credit, I'd say, of the Cuban government, they have not used him in any way, in a publicity way. They've tried to let him have as ordinary a life as possible.
Joan, I know that you are thrilled by what we've been witnessing over the past two or three days. What are the greatest sources of your joy about the future of Cuba?
Well, I couldn't keep the tears away this morning when I listened to our president. I was very proud of him. He gave a brilliant speech, I think, to Cuba, including taking issues with some of the things on human rights that he feels that they need to be called on. He was courageous in doing that in their presence, but he also was courageous in saying to Cuba, you have done some remarkable things in medical care, in the education of children, in the possibilities that you've offered your people, but nobody sleeps in the doorway. People do not live great grand lives, but neither is there terrible poverty. And he acknowledged those things, and I think the very best of our president, who is born of an African father, which he talked about in his speech, came forth today. And so I have to give him credit for taking the chance of, I mean, he knows perfectly well that in this country he will be criticized not only by those in the other party, but those in his own party. It's, after all, an election year.
Yeah.
But I give him courage for taking, you know, his last days in office. He has a chance to be brave. And he took that chance.
We've both already alluded to the fact that you're leaving for Cuba just a few hours from the time that we're speaking. You will have opportunities to speak to many of the Cuban people. But if you could speak to the nation of Cuba, what would be your message to them at this point?
My message would be twofold. One was to thank them for the way in which they greeted the American president and therefore the American people. And I would pray for them that they could find the way to the freedom that at our best we have as a gift to give the world. And I do mean at our best. And I hope that the American people will now see Cuba for what it is, and that we can take down the walls that separate us, and that we will be able to be nation to nation, equal people who can be in contract with one another in ways that are finally devoid of years of prejudice.
Joan Brown Campbell, safe travels. Thank you so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. Thanks for having me. I'll say hello to Cuba for you.
The Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell was the first woman General Secretary of the National Council of Churches USA and the first woman Director of the U.S. Office of the World Council of Churches. Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said her voice helped to bring an end to the evil of apartheid. We taped this conversation on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Joan was back on a plane bound for Cuba. The Reverend Eduardo Gonzalez is the energetic pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church in Ciego de Ávila, Cuba. I've come to know him well through the partnership between his congregation and Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana. Eduardo Gonzalez, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gabby. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Eduardo, what has it been like in Cuba this week? In the streets, in the media, in your church, the President of the United States has been there. People have been excited about the possibilities of a closer relationship between two nations. What has it been like?
It's been a big going around here, and most of all, it's been a mixed feeling kind of at times here.
Tell me the mixed feeling you're talking about.
Some people are saying that the visit of President Obama will bring changes to Cuba. Some people believe that nothing is going to do to our situation. And there are some of us that believe that the visit of President Obama is just a result of the changes that have already been taking place in our country and also in the United States.
What is the real challenge that you have as the pastor of that church?
Well, my real challenge as a minister of my church and as a preacher of the good news that Jesus Christ came to this world to bring is trying to make people understand that we are actors of changes, that we are instruments of God, so we God expects us to do something to change the world into His kingdom.
Eduardo, how does the political situation, how does it impact what you say in your sermons?
Well, I think we are living times of revelation. We are living in times in which God is once again telling us that if we human beings created to the image of a powerful God get together and put our efforts in building the peace, the love, and the justice of His kingdom, we can do it. We can achieve things. And that is something that I think, at some extent, citizens of this world have lost. Because we are, on the side of the Christians, we have churches full of people expecting Jesus to come to bring His kingdom and doing nothing to be faithful to the Jesus that already came and live and die and resurrect for us. Yeah, on the political agenda, it's the same thing. We have people wanting the government to do things, wanting the government to bring changes, but they don't do nothing for making the government responsible to bring about those changes that they think should take place.
What has it been like this week with the members of your church? Are there diverse reactions, or is the same reaction, and what is that reaction?
We are living a spirit of victory, Dr. Gabby, because one of the things our church has been cut up for years is in trying to build bridges of love and understanding with the people of the United States. And it has been always our hope that through those bridges, our government would walk through. And finally, our governments are working over those bridges that for years, men and women from one side and the other have been building. And now seeing President Obama come to Cuba, being given the opportunity to address our people through the media alive, that's the biggest step in all these roles.
Eduardo, what is the relationship of your congregation with other denominations and with other religions in Cuba?
You know, we are a very ecumenical church. We believe that there is only one God and that there is many approaches to that God that people just interpret in different ways. And so we are open to all those people who even have different beliefs that we have.
Eduardo, what would you like for every American, especially every American of faith, to know about Cuba?
I really would love the American people to understand that we are a very diverse people. We are a very diverse country in terms of our religion, but we are very genuine, and we are just very open to continue to build this road that we have taken so far. The walk that we have walked so far is nothing compared to what is left to be walked in terms of many other things that can come along this way that we have just started to see the result of a long-term struggle.
Eduardo, give us an Easter greeting from Cuba.
Okay, Yo creo que el espíritu de ese Dios hecho carne que vivió, murió y resucitó con nosotros, resucite también en el pueblo de los Estados Unidos y el pueblo de Cuba, precisamente en estos tiempos en el que estamos reconciliándonos y tratando de construir, basado en el amor, el respeto y la justicia, una nueva relación. I wish a happy Easter, and I wish that the spirit of God who came to live, die, and resurrect for us be in every American and in every Cuban now, precisely at this moment in which we are just reconciliating with each other on this road of building new relationships.
The Reverend Eduardo Gonzalez is pastor of Emmanuel Baptist Church in Ciego de Ávila, Cuba. Eduardo is a native of Cuba who studied theology at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. He is the General Secretary of Cuban Coordination of Baptist Students and Workers, a Christian movement member of the Cuban Council of Churches. Eduardo, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief today. I'd like to wish you and your congregation a very happy Easter.
Thank you, Dr. Gabby.
W. Craig Henry is a longtime friend of mine. He's an attorney and a leader in the decades-old partnership between Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana, and a Baptist congregation in Cuba. I'm happy to welcome Craig to the State of Belief studios. Craig, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Elton. Good to be here.
Let's start with you giving us just a brief history of the partnership between Northminster Church in Monroe and Emmanuel Church in Cuba.
Well, in 1994, we were at an Alliance of Baptists gathering and discovered that a couple of years previously, a couple of churches in the Alliance had begun partnering with churches in Cuba. And this was something the Alliance of Baptists was fostering with the Fraternity of Cuban Baptist Churches, which is a group of progressive Baptist churches in Cuba. So we, in the summer of 1994, you and Dolores Lindsay and D.H. Clark and I went to Cuba, led by Stan Hasty, then the executive director of the Alliance, looking for a church partnership. And we discovered that partnership and actually fell in love with the people in Ciego de Ávila, Reverend Noel Fernandez, his wife Amara Noya, being the founding leaders of that congregation, Turi Paz, also a nationally known journalist in Cuba, also a founding member of that congregation.
How many times have you been to Cuba yourself?
Well, at least once a year since 1994, so over 25 times, I think.
You have any idea the number of people from Northminster that we have taken down there?
Over 30. Yes.
That is just terrific. I remember the first time we went.
And it was hot.
It was really, really hot. Really hot. And no air conditioning and lots of flies.
Right.
What do you think is most important about this international relationship?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is that it's a mutual relationship, and certainly that's difficult for us being North Americans and with all the privileges we have. And what we usually do is like to boss people around and tell people what they have to do, and yet we found in Cuba people just like us, and these were Baptists, third-generation Baptists, who knew what to do. We didn't need to tell them what to do. And so it became a very mutual relationship, mutual love, mutual prayer concerns. Certainly we provide what financial support we can provide, which they need, but it's very much a partnership of mutuality.
You know, I am stunned when I think back on this relationship about how much we have learned from Cuban Baptists, feeling like we've learned a lot more than perhaps we've given, because they have been so giving to us. And one of the things, Craig, that has always impressed me is those people live on an island. We think of that as being very isolated. The leaders of that congregation are connected to the world. and we learned something about international relations from them.
Absolutely. Noel is very much involved with the World Council of Churches. Even though he's pastor emeritus now, he's works full-time with the World Council of Churches on their commission on disability. He's been blind since he was a young man from retinitis pigmentosa. And he travels all over the world. And yes, he very much has a world view, as does Eduardo, who's been to many places in the world now as well, including many times to the United States.
Is there anything about Christian communities in Cuba that you have found particularly striking and embraced and said, we ought to really benefit from this back home?
There's such a spirit of love and hospitality there, not only in the churches, but in Cuba in general. We've found so much hospitality. In spite of people not having very much materially, yet they share what they have with us and with one another. It's very much a hospitable country, and the church is very hospitable people.
We may have been walking together when this happened, but I remember us walking together one day in Havana, just out on the streets, and we passed by a family that was sitting on the porch, and I think they were having some coffee, and they stopped us and said, why don't you all come up and talk to us? And we sat on the porch and drank some of that coffee, which, oh my goodness. But anyway, you're exactly right about these kinds of hospitable moments. Almost every time we have been to Cuba, we have sat down for a conversation with the communist leaders in that community.
Yes.
I think there is a stereotype that people in Cuba and religions in Cuba are under the watchful eye of the Communist Party and that it is oppressive. That honestly has not been our experience, has it?
That has not been our experience. Of course, we, not being there on a full-time basis, we're not certain exactly what the relationship is, but we gather that at least since at some time prior to our partnership in 1994, the Cuban government has been very open toward religion. It was not in the early days of the revolution, but later the government opened up toward religion, and religion's been very free in Cuba for many, many years.
In fact, in our conversations with the party, they have been very interested in what's going on in the churches and been supportive of what's going on in the churches. And you're right. We don't know what happens when we're not there, but we have good friends there who tell us a lot of what happens. But there is not an obvious conflict or compulsion that is changing the nature of religion in Cuba.
No, there's not. As a matter of fact, as one example, I would point out that the provincial Communist Party official who was in charge of religious affairs in Ciego de Ávila province has met us on every occasion that we have been to Cuba. He's now retired, but he's become a good friend of ours, actually, mm-hmm. and we've shared many, many conversations together. He's been very supportive of our partner church in Manuel. Of course, in Manuel is very much involved in the community socially, providing so many social needs in the community. So it's really been a good partnership there as well.
Craig, what have you learned about the Cuban people or about the Cuban government that if you told a group of people in the United States this is the way it is, they would be really surprised?
Well, I think that people are probably freer in Cuba to speak their minds, at least among one another, than most people would think in a communist rural country, because people very freely speak to us, our friends do.
And we actually, in the more recent visits there, have seen a lot more economic interest and freedom for people to start their own businesses and make their own money.
Yes. When we first went in 1994, it was during the what they call their special period after the fall of the Soviet Union. and the economy was no longer being propped up by billions of dollars from the Soviet Union. So it was a very difficult time. Remember, we'd go for miles on the autopista and not see another vehicle. Well, now you see vehicles everywhere, and that's a combination of a lot of things. The Cuban government during the special period brought in, you know, entered into more partnerships with foreign companies to increase tourism, to bring in dollars. And then now, yes, the government in Cuba over the last few years under Raul Castro has allowed private enterprise in many instances where over a 500,000 Cubans are working in private enterprise. And so we see a lot more economic activity in Cuba. It seems like things are getting better and better economically for the Cuban people.
I will tell my favorite memory of our trips, and it came on the very first one when we were actually exploring the idea of a partnership between these two congregations. And I sat down one evening at the table with Noel Fernandez. We had never had a conversation before, and we started a conversation that evening went on and on and on. And I cannot ever forget the graciousness of Noel and his insistence that he knows that our church has money he doesn't have. He knows that we know they don't have much money to work with. But he was adamant that he did not want a relationship based on an exchange of funds that would be a one-way street. One of the questions he asked me over and over was, how can we help you? What can we do to make your church better? What can we do to be of benefit to that congregation? And that has been the spirit with which this whole thing has gone on. And from that evening, it was almost as if, well, I somehow have known you before, and we have such common interests, and we have grown to be devoted friends to each other. That's a memory that's lasting for me. What do you remember?
Well, there's so many memories, it's hard to pick out. But one that helps people understand, I think, something about the hospitality of the Cuban people. This was on our first visit in 1994 when people actually didn't have enough food in Cuba because of the difficult economic situation. And we went to the little community of Piedrecitas, which is just east of Ciego de Avila. And everywhere we went, and we went to many different places, everybody just gave us wonderful food. And obviously, it was all the food that they had. Well, on this one occasion, they killed the, quote, fatted pig. Well, it wasn't fat. It was the scrawniest pig that we'd ever, well, you know, it was hard to find the meat. And we sat in this backyard and ate and had this great celebration, just an example of the hospitality of the Cuban people that we've continued to experience. Several baptism experiences at our partner church. They baptize once a year, and they baptize in rivers. And we were on one occasion at baptism, and every time I've been, when one of our ministers has not been, they've asked me to preach. Well, I'm not a preacher, but I give devotional thoughts. But I preached on the passage about Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch and about the gospel being for everyone. And our partner church is so much like Northminster in that we do believe that the gospel's for everyone. And they've made that clear from the very beginning. But just that experience on the riverbank under the coffee trees, actually, we were near Chambas at a coffee plantation of one of the members of the Chambas mission at that time.
A nationally recognized attorney and founding and active member and leader of Northminster Baptist Church in Monroe, Louisiana, W. Craig Henry has played a vital role in the ongoing partnership between our congregation and Emmanuel Baptist Church in Ciego de Avila, Cuba. Craig, thank you so much for coming on today and being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. It's been a great pleasure.
I have to tell you that this week's show was a very moving experience for me. I've got to know the Cuban people pretty well. I have great admiration for them. I have watched the way they have coped with being isolated from the greatest nation on earth and what that has deprived them of experiencing in so many different ways. I've seen them, as Dr. John Brown Campbell said, come up with some real initiatives of importance in the medical realm. And if they had had the kind of medications that others in the world have, it would have been even better. But these people are not a complaining people. They are people who smile. They are people with hope. And let me tell you, they are people who admire the United States almost to a point of concern on my part. It's wonderful to see them excited about the possibility of a greater role in the international community because of a relationship with the United States. Like our church has learned from them, our country can learn from them, and certainly they can benefit us. This is Easter Sunday weekend. Easter is all about resurrection, about coming back to life, about resurrecting that which ought to be living and yet is not. I think we're seeing some resurrections take place, not the kind of bodily resurrections that some talk about on Easter Sunday, but what a friend of mine called ordinary resurrections. Resurrections that bring hope to the lives we lead every day and to the relationships that we experience in our nation and in our nation's relationships with other nations. It's been a very moving show for me. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. This program needs to be on the air. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the ongoing discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.